I should just say I have no relationships to disclose either.
Can we all say it right now?
Yeah.
We all have no relationships.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. Ladies and gentlemen, law is an important tool for the prevention of obesity and other risk factors for chronic disease, especially when it helps to create positive environments that support and encourage healthier lifestyles. Change doesn't always depend on law, of course. Sometimes you just need to think innovatively. I took this photo in San Sebastian, Spain last year, and what it shows, of course, is a sporting field that is completely covered by the tide every few hours. But I want to talk about law. Law and government decisions play a critical role in shaping the many decisions about the built environment. And legal and regulatory approaches deserve our attention for three reasons. First of all, the regulations that shape the physical built environment can influence patterns of behaviour in ways that improve the average health status of the population. Secondly, law and regulation also have the capacity to address the socio-economic inequalities in the burden of disease that are crystallised at the level of place. In other words, law plays a role in social justice, in helping to improve the more equitable distribution of the conditions that are necessary to lead a healthy life. And the third reason why law deserves our attention is because it can contribute to sustainability. Health-enhancing environmental policies have the capacity to contribute to responsible national and global goals for the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. I was hearing this morning about the urban edge agricultural parks that combine dual use parkland and working sustainable agriculture. And I think this is a major theme that we're going to hear more from in the future. But if this is the promise of law and regulation, then how will these changes actually be achieved? And this is where our understanding, and this is where the literature is a little bit thin. Typically, the contribution that law can make is discussed in two ways. We hear about specific environmental outcomes and policies that law might help bring about. For example, better access to nutritious food, greater opportunities for physical activity in safe and attractive open spaces, and better public transport encouraging incidental physical activity and reducing congestion. And I want to call this the policy basket. Our task as health advocates and scholars is to identify a plausible health policy basket, sort of a basket of regulatory interventions that could improve the quality of the local environment. And epidemiological data and economic analysis and conceptual frameworks help us identify the contents of the basket. Secondly, the law's contribution is discussed rather more vaguely in terms of enabling strategies that are capable of achieving these environmental changes. And by that I mean, you know, for example, zoning and land use controls to do things like reduce the density of fast food outlets or require developers to improve the quality of public amenities and green space as a condition to development. So I'm going to refer to these as the legal pathways to environmental change. And I think the most significant gap in the literature and in our understanding is in the specific legal pathways through which we might catalyse the changes or the things that we want to do in our policy basket. How many of you in the audience who are advocates for comprehensive policy change actually have a clear understanding of the multiple legal levers that you would need to press in order to do all the weird and wonderful things that you'd like to do to the food and physical activity environment? And yet identifying a coherent set of legal pathways for implementing the different parts of the policy basket is really important. Otherwise, how do you know who has power to do what? What's feasible and what's not? Where to direct your advocacy with respect to different parts of the policy or different parts of the policy basket, where the gaps are, where you should be advocating for legal change in order to implement your policy. Now, some people have argued that what we need is comprehensive paradigm shift in policy making. I prefer the analogy of the camel's nose under the rug. I think changing our food and physical activity environment will be a slow and incremental process, but we need many changes. not just one or two, and we want to implement as much of our policy basket as we can. So where does law fit in? Well, you know, environmental and policy approaches are often contrasted with approaches that try to change individual behaviours. And the widely accepted paradigm for understanding the determinants of health calls attention to a cascading set of influences. And you can see them on the slide. They range from global factors all the way down to our genes and the role of healthcare system interventions. So this cascading set of determinants produces individual and collective states of health and illness. Now, we can look at this hierarchy of influences upon health as creating opportunities for interventions at each level. Some of these interventions will be legal ones and others won't be. Well, you can see from where I've inserted the fingers on this diagram that I would argue that the best opportunities for the law are in creating enabling policies and supportive environments. And you'll notice that in this way, the law manages to influence patterns of behaviour, but without micromanaging individuals' lives. And that's important given our expectations of civil rights. The second point I want to make is that in federal systems like the United States and like my own country, Australia, progressive federal regulation can be very difficult to achieve. But local and city area change can overcome the inertia and the lack of responsiveness and the political obstacles that might exist at higher levels. So this is what we're seeing with restaurant and menu labelling in this country, with the ban on trans fats that's spreading at city level across the states. The ban on smoking in beaches in my own city and in yours, and bans on smoking in cars carrying children and also certain apartment buildings. I suspect it's only a matter of time until some enterprising local council will decide that being the healthiest city really means smart politics, or really is smart politics. And that could challenge our assumptions about public health and democracy in rather surprising ways. But why is it so complex? You know, it's locally driven regulatory change that improves the environment will tend to be complex. And why is that? I think there's three reasons. Firstly, you've got lots of items in the policy basket. Secondly, federalism makes implementation complex because regulatory controls over the contents of any proposed policy basket will be either shared or allocated between the federal, state and local levels of government, or between, you know, government agencies and agency heads. And it's this jurisdictional variation that means that no size fits all. So identifying the legal pathways to improving the food and physical activity environment in San Diego may look quite different from doing it in Sydney, Australia. And that's why I'm not talking in technical legal terms, because it wouldn't do much help. But I can't honestly say I've ever read any account that specifically charts the legal pathways for implementing a policy basket within any particular jurisdiction. And this is one area where public health lawyers, I think, can work with advocates on the challenge of making change happen. So let's focus for a moment on one subset of what we're talking about, one conceptual domain, a physical or outdoor environment that supports physical activity. And I've expressed this as an outcome in this slide, and I've identified conceptual elements that we may wish to regulate in the pink on the bottom of the slide, and I've also identified in the red some attributes that will help us to achieve our goal. Well, this next slide then goes into this in a little bit more detail. It identifies, and I know you can't read it, it identifies some of the tasks and some of the key issues that regulation might help to address. And it's not a comprehensive list, but that's okay. You know, a wish list is one thing, but getting it implemented is another. Now, a good public health lawyer should be able to identify the legal routes that might help you implement or action this policy wish list. But in doing so, there are some strategic issues that we need to keep in mind. And I'll give you some New South Wales examples because it's in New South Wales, you know, that I'm currently trying to map out these specific legal pathways. And the first issue is, do adequate legal powers exist to implement this policy, or should we advocate for law reform? So happily, in some cases, you'll have specific powers, specific statutory powers that will help you do the things you want to do. So government, you merely need to convince government to do the things or to use the power it already has, although perhaps in new ways. So to give you one Australian example, the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act in my own state explicitly states that state and local environmental planning instruments can deal with advertising. And that's important. It means that there's no legal impediment, for example, to a local council restricting the advertising of, you know, what are defined as unhealthy foods or alcoholic beverages, or regulating certain types of advertising as a land use or zoning issue. In considering law reform, it's helpful to consider also how health regulation might leverage off environmental regulation, because our experience with that is more extensive. So, for example, adding health as a statutory objective in environmental assessment and planning regulation would be a really powerful advance, because it would mean that that health would be taken into account as an objective in the development of standards, which will then be used to determine land use controls and planning. So would formalising the practice of health impact assessment, as well as just environmental impact assessment. Second issue to bear in mind when considering whether adequate powers exist is the impact of federalism. So there may be alternative processes for achieving the same thing. Advocacy can proceed at two levels, and that's really important to remember: bottom up or top down. And some pathways, some legal pathways, are going to be more powerful than others. So in New South Wales, for example, the Minister for Planning can require local councils to repeal and review their environmental planning instruments. So clearly the most powerful way for driving change on a broad scale would be by using state powers to catalyse local action across the state. Now, some things like improving amenity or developing green space can be adequately, or perhaps they're best, done at the local level. But when it comes to creating continuity in bicycle paths, for example, councils need to get together. Or perhaps in my case, you've got a hilly city with all sorts of local councils. If you want continuity of bike paths throughout the city, it really needs to be a city-wide planning effort, which really means a statewide legal instrument rather than a local council planning instrument. Public transport planning also tends to be a silo of its own that is worked out at the state level, simply because of the financing considerations. Now, important thing to notice is that no one council or government is going to be responsible or capable, really, of implementing the full policy basket. It's going to be fragmented or desiccated. And intergovernmental coordination will be needed, and this requires leadership and indeed some level of agreement about the right things to put into the policy basket. It also requires new and innovative intergovernmental processes for consulting and for planning policy, and I would rate this as probably the most important challenge for an effective response to chronic disease generally. The level of government issue is also important when we consider financing these changes. So the final consideration to bear in mind when studying legal pathways is that change is going to be slow. One of the main ways that land use planning can transform the built environment is by prohibiting new development or requiring it to comply with conditions. But change will occur very slowly if all we do is integrate health into brand new developments on the city fringe, or redevelopments that are driven by the private sector. There's also the challenge of repairing health-corroding environments in the present, retrofitting our existing infrastructure in order to mitigate harmful effects. And this can be difficult. It can require new investments by government, but what I mean, money, You know, and where does the money come from? The money may have to come from the federal level. You know, you have a pot of money at the federal level. Councils can then sort of have an incentive to compete for it when they're going to do sort of worthwhile things in their local area. You can also have opposition from landowners, concerned, for example, with the impact of mixed-use development on residential land values. So in conclusion, I've tried to say nothing technical, not give you any mention any specific laws, but to keep things a little bit more conceptual. The legal pathways to policy implementation will vary in each jurisdiction, but the legal detail of each jurisdiction will also provide us with new ideas and new strategies that have wider application, and there's a lot of learning to be done from that. We need more than the policy basket. We need change, and that requires a clear map of the pathways to implementing our vision of a healthier and active community. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Roger? Roger, you have a question here.